I won't. I'll cut this bit out of the podcast, right? Is that a thing? Is that a thing that happens?
We'll open it up for comments and questions about the book, if you've read it or any part of it, about what Richard has said. I think this is a free-for-all, yeah.
So sadly, the audio hasn't captured for the questions. So what I plan to do is to listen as hard as I can with my old ears, and I'll give you a précis of what those questions are, and then I'll clip back in the answers I gave. So the first question was from my friend Klaus, who spoke about the fact that in the indignation chapter of my book, there's a corollary with dignity. So I push indignation towards dignity and what it is to act in a dignified way. He asked me to elaborate on that a little bit with its link to hope as a kind of potential flag to the future. And he went on to talk about how ancient Greeks referred to hope as a duality of ways of engaging in the present moment, either as a means of stopping you acting because you hoped that you could defer things to the future, or as an enabler to action.
On my professorial inaugural, on the front cover, I had courage, faith, justice, hope and peace on the front, because I was thinking quite a lot about value, economic value. We didn't talk about law of value.
No, we should though.
The idea that labour adds value, that labour is the source of value, that value is the system in motion, how it expands, perpetuates, reproduces. We have to have value. So when I see value for money, I'm always kind of, well, what do you mean by that then? What does value mean in that context? How are you taking value? And what I'm interested in is kind of value, the idea of values, and values obviously because it's a system, and our lives operate inside that system, and that system is infecting our lives in more and more ways. So it takes up more time. We're on emails at weekends. We're writing blog posts on weekends. I'm writing that book on evenings and weekends. The system's in us more and more and more, and our values are constructed around that. So I'm thinking all the time about, oh my God, what does it mean to be courageous in that system then? Am I being courageous to reproduce myself for the system and in the system, or am I against the system? Is my courage against that? Is it co-opted inside that? But for me, there's something about the relationship between value and values, so our humanity, value, which is something that's extracted from us and is taken from us, and I have that kind of whole, and it's an awful thing, you know, and I'm doing it from here, right, because it's in our hearts, but it's also the alien thing, alienation, it's the alien thing in the film, so it's erupting, it's something toxic that's infected us, and it's inside us, and it's erupting here, you know, and we can't control it, and it's gone, and then it's off to metastasize and infect something else, so it's something that's in us, but it's not of us. And it's anti-human and it's inhumane. And it forces us to walk past people on the streets. And it forces us to ignore pain and suffering. And it forces us not to have compassion for people who are, for that outpouring of anxiety and depressive positions and mental health crises inside institutions, you know. So there's an eruption of that. And we try to deal with it, but we can't deal with it. We can't deal with it in a way that is anything other than commodified a lot of the time. Not all of the time, and obviously I don't want to paint polarized positions. But part of it for me comes back to, well, that other half of kind of Marx's work. What does it mean to be human then in this space? And what does it mean to be human now is not what it meant to be human when my mum and dad were growing up. Very different in terms of, you know, I was talking to my dad about it, you know, and it, the world failed and he got another job. Not necessarily the case now. And, you know, and I see people who are brilliant people who are fighting for something else and want the career or can't get the career. And it's kind of, well, how do I operate with a sense of compassion in that moment and care in that moment? And how do I reframe the world not around the commodity, the commodification of me and you and our relationship and the things that I make? Because the book's just the book's a way marker in a process of who I am, right? It isn't and read it, you know, and then tell me whatever you want to tell me, you know. It's meaningless, Richard, where's the dictionary? Blah, 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 too theoretical, all that stuff. Tell me that whatever. But it's a way marker of me trying to make sense of the world, but it's just a way marker. I'm not interested in it as a commodity. I'm proud of it, but I'm not interested in it as a commodity. But I am interested in our relationship, and I'm interested in how in this space we can walk through this space with dignity, and what does that mean? You know, and that doesn't mean I'm going to fight everything and try and break everything and everything's crap and whatever it is and I get the sack and I'm out. Because it's a constant everyday judgment about what's working and what isn't working and who am I and what is my relationship to you and can I make it more human? Can I make it more human? Or am I being forced to dehumanize myself and you? And I think it's just having an awareness of it. For me, part of that is why in it, certainly at the start, I'm trying to think about this in terms of other people's positions. Because how can I be a dignified human being if I'm not aware of who is marginalized and who doesn't have a voice and who is bastardized and brutalized in my everyday work? But there's a sense of, well, how do I understand the world from your position as well as mine? I'm not trying to co-opt it, but I just get a better understanding of it. And there's some dignity in that rather than me sort of thinking, oh my God, I'm separated from you. I don't understand you. I can't understand you. I can't be with you. I'll outsource a solution for you over there. Can we negotiate a solution? I don't know. So dignity is really, for me, dignity is that opposite of indignation is really important, I think. And how do we enact it though? Not just how do we leave it in a policy? How do we enact it every day? Forget the policy. How do we enact it every day?
Friend Catherine raised the next question. She made a statement about how she was trying to explain to some of her students how the system works. She wanted to know whether that was a useful strategy, in particular because they were quite shocked at how the NSS worked, how student satisfaction surveys worked, how they were compiled into league tables, what that was used in order to make judgments, what it was used for, how it was used to make judgments around future earnings. And that she felt that in those conversations she was being subversive or transgressive. And she wondered whether that was a useful strategy, but she also wondered why we had to keep those things secret and was she putting herself in jeopardy?
It's really difficult, isn't it? Because like we don't have a literacy around so much stuff in society. So we don't have We don't have a literacy around finance, around governance, around how we construct collectively around how we construct our everyday life. Again, it's kind of outsourced to money or policymakers or whatever else. So I think the very fact that you're having that conversation is vital and it's important, it's really powerful, but at the same time it's complicated, isn't it? Because you're talking about, and if you're taking as a starting point them and what it is and their hopes and aspirations and why they're here or where, whichever university it's in, why they're in that space, what it is that they want. And I had a really interesting conversation with some master's students last week. Why are you here? Effectively, self-improvement and also societal improvement. They're not necessarily, and a secondary gain is employability and its earnings. But it's not a primary gain. But the thing that is spun by the policy, and it's really interesting then to sort of say, okay, let's unlock that then. And what does that mean in terms of the £9,250? And can we have a conversation about that? And whether you think that's too high, about right, too low, whether you think it should be differential, can we have a conversation about what you get for that? You know, and the fact that it hasn't really risen since they were first brought in. So for institutions, that's really problematic for institutions that are trying to provide this basket of stuff, and that there's a policy framework around that as well, which demands certain efficiencies and value for money. And the value for money thing is locked into assets like these buildings and your IT infrastructure and your journal and the journals you can access and the books. We don't really think about it in terms of the staffing necessarily, and you see that across the sector. But there are all sorts of things in that space that you can then unlock and open up. But then we've got a conversation about policy and why policy is framed in that way, and the Treasury's 2015 productivity plan that everything has to pivot around, and the fact that since 2008 we have not been able to get stable forms of accumulation and growth back on the road, and we celebrate 0.2% GDP growth or whatever it is, you know. And then so it's a really complicated and messy space, isn't it, to try to open. The very fact that you're opening it up is a brilliant thing, situated from where they're coming from. Why are you here? Let's talk about your access to the labs. Let's talk about me. Let's talk about your, because at that moment you can then have a conversation about the relationship between them and you. Because the one thing that's missing from a lot of the dialogue about higher education, certainly in terms of policy, the Office for Students, in terms of what ministers will be talking about, is the relationship between higher education, universities, the subject, and the individual student or her family and or her carers, staff. Where are they then in that conversation? And actually what we want to do is to reformulate that and to say that there's a bigger community here. And we do it. We have it in the, and I will have it with my first year students, and we will have it with our students all the time. We'll have that. But actually there's a conversation to be had there, I think, that is really powerful about, well, what do you get access to for your 9250? And what does that mean, the very fact that you carry, do you carry that? Do you carry that as a debt, or don't you carry that as a debt? Because it's like a loan outlay, right? But there's other debts you carry in terms of kind of maintenance and how you support yourself and all of that kind of stuff. So you can open up all sorts of conversations there about their relationship to you and the fact that their relationship to you is mediated by money and the market and hedge funds and those who provide accommodation. And if you're in London, that's a nightmare because the overheads are whatever they are. You know, and what debt are you going to end up with there? And the very fact that there's an insertion there in the relationship between you and them, but there's also an insertion in there in the relationship between them and whoever else is providing their healthcare or their dental plan or their social care or what's going on with their grandmother or what's going on with whoever it is. So you get the opportunity to explode what's happening here as a heuristic for looking at other things. You maybe don't want to do that because, like, you're lecturing in, like, at the ethics of computing, right? So you maybe don't want
to
have that.
This comes up in research methods where I teach them how to use Likert scales, and I use the NSS and things like that as an example, right? Because there are expectations of what you're supposed to put on, you know, if it's anything other than a 5, it's rubbish, right? So, or 1 or whatever end the scale's at. But yeah, so that's how this conversation comes up, but then it's all of 10 minutes and that's it, you know.
But it's like, do you have agency, isn't it? Mm. It's an opening gambit for, do you have agency to change your world? Can you do something different or not? And actually, what does it mean if you put a 5 or a 4 or a 3 or a 2 or a 1? And who gets punished in that moment?
Yeah.
And how are you being commodified in that moment? And how is your data being compartmentalized, separated from you, repackaged as something and sold on? Or how is it being used to discipline? And I think it's opening up that really to say that actually the evidence isn't simply that using a Likert scale for whatever is just about exploring an objective truth about the world. Because actually you can't understand the objective truth about the world. Thank you, Mark, for forcing me to become module leader for evidence-based teaching and learning. You can't, I finally grasped it. You can't understand that without understanding, it's dialectical, right? You can't understand it without understanding its relationship to all these other things. Trying to open that up is really difficult, and we don't have the space for it inside universities. So maybe we don't do it inside the formal curriculum. Maybe we try to find space, but maybe we do it outside. But part of that is about student and staff organising. It's about how do we remake the university as a scholarly community rather than as a separated out, estranged, commodified space. I don't know how we do that. I ain't got the answers, but that's the starting point.
Are some of them not on the screen?
You are?
Are some of the answers not on the screen?
What, my nan?
Yes, your nan. Absolutely.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Maybe no, I'm just, it's, I don't want to take time away from questions. It's just, I want to note that most of the stuff that you have up there is autonomous and cooperative and radical education outside that interfaces and intersects with the university.
I think that's really important to remember that there are loads of people doing, looking for actually existing alternatives. And they're not just in this country. There's a deep history. There's a deep social and cultural history that's global. And there are people who are more schooled in it than me of stuff that's happening in Latin America or South America in autonomous centers, that's happening around social care in Greece after the collapse. That there's all sorts of organizational work going on, but also educationally in this country, there's buckets of stuff that's going on that might be small scale, that is actually existing now, or that has a longer lineage that we kind of forget about. But we almost need to unearth, not in order to say that's the blueprint, but in order to say we're stitched into something. There is a community here. There is a set of practices here.
The third question came from my friend and colleague, Sana. She pointed out that I kept referring to the idea of space, using the word space. She pointed out that there's quite a lot of practical theoretical work on the idea of safe spaces, and the idea that they don't really exist, they're utopian terms or generalized terms. She argued that in each space, there are some bodies that are more at risk than others. Some bodies face more consequences, primarily because they have less privilege. She argued that she was not expecting a solution to this from me, but she wondered what my thoughts are, in particular where in some spaces, some people have more dignity than others, or are allowed more dignity than others.
No, I agree with you, and I wouldn't feel dignified in that space if somebody else was not. But that's me, right? And I'm for whatever reason, I'm kind of attuned to all of that, and the very thought of it makes me feel sick. And you are right that there are overlays on this, and there are excavations of it, and that. There are a number of people that I come back to, and Sara Ahmed is one of those who talks about this a lot, and I don't want to fetishize her work particularly, but it's one of the reasons why I've always then tried to think about, well, who is blocked, who is stopped then, who can have the conversation, who can't have the conversation. If we're doing work on, which is national across the sector, on attainment for groups made marginal, well, what does that mean then? Who's setting the parameters? Who's defining the parameters of that? How far does that go? I had a conversation yesterday with someone from another university about their experience of that. And it was effectively the white deputy vice chancellor saying, 40%, decolonize the content of the curriculum. 40%, that'll do, that's it. We are not going anywhere else, culturally or structurally. We're not going anywhere else, you know. So there's a moment, isn't there, I think, for people like me in my writing to try to point to those other narratives and to hear them and to tell people, I'm not going to reproduce your narrative, but I'm going to say, whoa, there's some really interesting stuff over there. We should all go and listen. We should go and listen to that stuff, because that stuff's really, because we ain't going to change the world. We're not going to change the world from the perspective of the white male middle class professor. But those people need to be part of something else, for sure. But actually, those other positions then need to be respected. We need to have this. That's be a kind of level of dignity. So we need to kind of begin to find ways to voice issues around decolonizing, what it might mean for that. And I don't know whether that's possible here. But what it does mean is that I think you need conversations and ways of connecting between the work that's going on here, perhaps with trade unions, and the work of Roads Must Fall, or the work of Black Lives Matters, or the work of a million other anti-oppressive groups who have been doing this work forever and are exhausted from having to do this work forever, who have been doing this work in the community forever, to say, actually, are there moments of solidarity? Are there points of solidarity in this space? And what do we do? What can we do, therefore, differently? And it may well be that we have to say we can't do anything differently in here for us as a collective. You know, and I'm well aware that when I say space, it's like my space. I'm not trying to speak for you at all. And I completely accept that it must be so different for you in terms of your experience of here or there or when you go to present at Birkbeck or wherever it is. It must be so different, you know. So I think for me in that, there is a sense of what is we collectively discuss what happens, what is possible here versus what is possible out there, knowing that there's a different set of futures we might describe. Part of it is, and I've talked too much today, but part of it is people like me need to shut up, maybe, facilitate something else. But that is part of the issue, isn't it, I think. So I'm really, so thank you for your intervention, because it's really important, and it's a reminder that I can't generalize around ideas of space or time even. Because there's time's really important, because you will be, the expectations I'm assuming on you in terms of your time, and there's quite a lot of research about this, right, of who has to pick up the emotional labour, the emotional work in institutions, and who has to do all of that, and who has to reproduce, and then who has to go home and reproduce themselves when they've had all of this stuff been dumped in their room about from students. You know, and what therefore do they have to do to reproduce themselves to go back out and do it again tomorrow? There was a really important, very important way into this for me was a brilliant paper that Sarah wrote with Sarah Motta about what it means to be a mother in the university and what is expected of you and the norms that are applied to you. How do you demonstrate that you can perform in that space? What does performance look like? Don't really care that you're a mum. Where are your ref outputs?
The next question came from my friend Rachel, who was pointing out that in some of her research with students, those individuals were regarding the institution as a safe space and outside as unsafe. And she wanted to know what I felt about that.
I think that there's an infrastructure. Sorry, Sarah, did you want to say something?
Yes, after you.
No, you say.
No.
There's an infrastructure, isn't there, that's put in place. Places like this are focused on the student experience and on student support and on having and there's an infrastructure both centrally and in faculties and in departments, and I see this in the education team. There's an infrastructure that's put in place that is actually, I absolutely want to help you to become the person you want to become in this moment, not as a fetishized you can earn 30 grand or whatever it is, but actually I don't want you to fail. I want you to achieve. I want you to exit. I want you to attain. I want you to progress. I want to see that smile on you. I see it at graduation. I want to see the smile on your face, and I want the photo with you and your family. I see that all the time at graduation, and it's absolutely lovely when those people, you know, and in particular those people with whom you work, and they think, actually, I've had several conversations, and Mark and I have had long conversations. I'm very sorry about my daily phone call to you, but there's been long conversations. There've been quite a lot of conversations about these things are going on. What do I need to do? And I think we all come out of those. We come out of teaching, and we come out of our sessions with students thinking, oh my God, did that work? Didn't it work? Why did it work? Why didn't it work? Have I failed? Have I not failed? You know, are they with me? Do they hear me? Am I connecting with them? And I think we do that. We do that all. I think most of us do that most of the time. So I can understand completely that they feel. The flip side is we want to hold them, but we don't want to hold them so much that we infantilize them, that they can't take ownership. That's the flip side, isn't it? Really. And how do we then help them? But I think there's an infrastructure here, and there's a set of relationships here that, in spite of the Weltschmerz that we might feel, in spite of the alienation and the estrangement that we might feel, we throw energy, we answer emails at 11 or 2 or 6 or whenever it is. We go the extra mile on giving feedback. We do all of this other stuff because we want them to succeed. you know. So I completely understand why they would feel safe in that space, because there is an infrastructure here. I'm not saying it's everywhere, but I think that there's an infrastructure and a set of, and there is a thing about care. And I think there's a really interesting thing for us to think about in our relationship with students about what does care mean in that space? What does care mean in the classroom? And how do we take that from inside the classroom into the community? So I can completely understand that they do feel safe and the outside isn't. And one of the issues is, how do we support the transition from inside to out? Because it ain't going to be the same.
Fifth question was asked by my friend and colleague, Mark, who pointed out that the idea of cooperation and solidarity and care in the classroom between staff and students is framed by an end goal for those students. And what does that mean in light of this argument?
Well, it's mediated, isn't it, by, you know, the end point is they're paying $9,250 for a certificate that's a positional good that enables them to unlock stuff. So it is never a direct relationship between you and them. It is always a relationship that's however much you might want it to be about love and care and fellowship, it is always mediated by other stuff, and then other people have got a say in it. The Daily Mail will be writing stuff, you know, Times Higher's comparing us all, whatever that is. So there's always that that's thrown in. It's never a direct relationship. And that's always a problem. But then on top of that, we also have the psychological thing of, we want to throw in all of the care and attention and love that we can, but is that infantilizing? And actually is part of this, which is about the essence and the estrangement and the reconnection of yourself with who you might truly be, or the understanding of yourself, not just as a fetishized academic or a fetishized student. You are you, you are Mark, I am Richard. What's our relationship to each other? What's our relationship to ourselves? Who are we? Who do we want to be? Who might we be? Or are we just a senior lecturer? You know, or are we just a professor? Are we just a dad? Are we just a caregiver? Are we just a whatever? You know, part of it is trying to help our students understand those conceptions of themselves, how they relate to themselves, who they are, and what those mediations are, in order they relate themselves as a subject to the world and to each other, you know. Part of that is that they do have to take ownership, because, you know, you can't live it for them, and it infantilizes them. So there's a deeply alienating thing in terms of what the system does to them, but the system forces behaviors on us. And that then further alienates us from them, and us from ourselves, and them from themselves, because we project behaviors onto them, because we're answering emails at 3 a.m. rather than letting them sit with them until the next morning or whatever, because we think we'll be punished, or we'll think they'll think less of us, or we think that that's what we should be doing. And we all get potentially diminished in the process because we don't have real relationships. The
next question came from my friend and comrade Marco, who brought us back to the material relations of production, our relations of production inside the university. He was arguing that it's okay to discuss dialogue and care and love in the classroom and the relationship between staff and students, but those are produced materially. And they also lead us into questions of how we collectively or individually fight a financial system that is furthering exploitation, proletarianization, subsumption. He was talking about, in this moment, the material realities of this playing out in terms of redundancies, but also how we have, in our focus or obsession with having a care-based approach to our relationships with students, that furthers exploitation because it raises expectations of what we will do for them. He went on to make a point about how it looks like capitalism is now infecting higher education, it's subsuming higher education under the law of value. And he was making the point of, well, welcome to the real world. This is what other people have been suffering for up to 200 years. So he then moved in on to sort of say, ask us what is to be done in terms of our material practice.
There's an issue here, isn't there, of power and who has power, and what do you do about power then? You don't, you know, do you just talk power out, or do you have to seize something? You know, but I'm not interested in a vanguardist position. I'm not interested in a select few seizing that. It's about trying to, for me, it's about the dialogue that builds the counter hegemonic position that joins the precariously employed staff up to the indentured student that joins, that reflects their position against hedge funds and the power of finance capital, but that also talks to them about the fact that these people can't get mortgages, or those people have got outsourced healthcare now. Those people can't get access to care, and actually, if in order to get care for their grandmother, they're going to have to sell all her assets in order to be able to fund that. So all of a sudden, their capital reservoir is being diminished. And the fact that that's happening for us, but there are bodies that are being brutalised all of the time in these spaces because they can't pass through and it bruises you. Or because you're punished or you're disciplined or whatever it is, and you internalise that on a daily basis. And it poisons you on a daily basis. But there is a sense in which, how do we build this thing through dialogue over here, and how do we build that, but then respecting that actually we're being disciplined. And the counterposition might require that you need to push against discipline. What does that mean then? Because then you need a conversation about what violence means. And I'm not saying that we go break things now. But the system is disciplinary and the system is violent on an everyday basis. And it is more violent to some people than to others. And part of us needs to reflect that. And there are non-violent ways of protesting against this. We have a whole history of those things as well. But you have to be willing to put your body on the line. It's one thing to write a book, isn't it? It's another thing, some of us in the room have been, to be kettled for hours. And to do that, not necessarily in a way that I want to hurt you or break you, but I'm going to put my body on the line. So part of it is a conversation about that as well. And you're right. That's my point about awakenings. People have been going through this forever, right? 200 years. All of a sudden, we thought this was safe. Don't feel very safe anymore. Thank you for that. I've talked enough. It's like 10 to 7. We should call it quits, shouldn't we?
Probably.
I think we should call it quits. Thank you very much for your questions. We'll kind of find a way of editing this, I think. And we'll bung it up. Somewhere online, I'll bring it up online, maybe in, we'll have episodes. That's enough content now for me for weeks, isn't it? We can put that up. I want to thank you very much. I want to thank Sarah. I want to thank all of you for coming. And I'll see you on the other side. Thank you very much.